I think we are joined now by Eve Engler. There, Eve.
How's it going, Phil?
Pretty good. You've written a great new book, A Propaganda System, How Canada's Government, Corporations, Media, and Academia Sell War and Exploitation. I would just pick that line right out of James Brown. He said, we've been duped. And your article on your website, eveengler.com, says you go straight after some journalists, and it seems apropos of your book. Why don't we just ask you if we can about that? I think you have a title something like, do you want to be duped, or explain that.
Psychophants are duped. Yeah, well, there's a recent piece on CBC by Aaron Dyer, basically providing the justification for the Canadian government trying to undermine what was planned for yesterday, elections in Haiti, which was going to be probably the most legitimate election taking place in Haiti in the past 16 years, with the most popular Aristide's party, Fermi Lavalas, being able to fully participate, as well as other left-wing forces. And basically, Washington 2 months ago decided it was going to withdraw any financial assistance, any observers, basically try to set the stage to undermine the election, which is an old tactic when it's looking like the wrong people are going to win. You try to undermine the election, and when you look like your people are about to win, all of a sudden it's the most democratic.
Sunshine and democratic.
Yeah, so, and basically, so, you know, Dyer just jumps in with a pretty intense justification of Canada doing this, following Washington, and basically, I think the title is Haiti Needs Some Tough Love. So Canada's been, you know, for the past 15 years, been doing all we can to help the backwards Haitians, and now we just have to, you know, have some tough love, and then democracy might come.
Oh, my gosh. You know, Eve, I thank goodness we're talking to you. I really didn't know that particular story. I hadn't noticed that. I have noticed that Lavalas has not been allowed to run for, what has it been, 10, 15 years. Couldn't even have their name on the ballot, right?
Exactly. And so basically first time.
That really is tough love, right, if it's love.
But, you know, it's the policy since Canada's support for ousting elected government, elected president, 2004, but also thousands of other elected officials. And it's a policy that continues. And it's a policy that is intimately tied in with media bias. In the book, I look at a few examples, the pretty extreme examples of bias on a whole series of issues, Haiti being one that's particularly stark, where after the earthquake, for instance, a year after the earthquake, 2010 earthquake, there was a Canadian press report that got the access to information, internal documents, Canadian government, showed that they were concerned with a popular uprising after the earthquake, and were concerned that Aristide might, then in exile in South Africa, might return to the country. And that's why Canada sent 2,000 troops to Haiti, alongside 10,000 American troops, to basically fill the political vacuum post-earthquake. Didn't send the heavy urban search and rescue teams, didn't send the tools that Canada has designed to basically, you know, get people out of rubble and provide basic care. And a year after the earthquake, it was proven with internal documents that the objective was a political objective in sending troops. And I did a Canadian newsstand search. This is in a Canadian press report. Press report, the story was only picked up by one newspaper across the country, the Kamloops Daily News, of all places.
But they didn't get the call from the boss saying, don't do that?
Yeah, exactly. Kamloops Daily News editor somehow had bit too much.
I was in the Marine Corps. We had a saying, there's always a 10% that don't get the word. So the Kamloops paper hadn't got the word.
Didn't get the word. Yeah. And another stark example of the media bias in Haiti is the media has completely ignored the Ottawa Initiative on Haiti, where 13 months before the coup, Canadian officials, American and French officials, basically plotted to oust the Aristide government and put Haiti under UN trusteeship, even though that was reported on as a trial balloon a year before the coup, reported on by L'Actualité, the Maclean's, Quebec's equivalent to Maclean's. It hasn't been touched on by any single corporate reporter in English language since that time. It's been mentioned in a couple op-eds by Haiti Solidarity activists, but mm-hmm. no corporate reporter has mentioned this meeting that's, you know, in the public record. It's been reported, mentioned by, you know, left media, alternative media, Haiti Solidarity activists, dozens, hundreds of times, but it's clearly not of enough news value for the dominant media in this country.
It might wake one of our sleeping opposition parties were it to appear in print. This is Eve Engler. The book, by the way, this is a book we urgently need. In your introduction, you touch on this subject from another direction, which I'm really fascinated by. You point out that in the discussion about the need probably to remove Mr. Aristide, they used the formula of responsibility to protect. And he is everybody understands, I believe, one of the most popular people in modern Haitian history. He's probably the most popular. And they were talking about R2P, am I right?
They were Denis Paradis, who was the then Minister for La Francophonie, Secretary of State for Latin America in the Chrétien government. He refers to it. Later on, the Canadian ambassador in Port-au-Prince, Kenneth Cook, refers to it. And one of the stories I mentioned in the book is that I, in two different columns that I've submitted to Huffington Post Canada, I put that in there, and I put links to the interview between Denis Paradis and Anthony Fenton, where he mentions responsibility to protect, put a link to internal document that Anthony Fenton, a researcher, got with showing the Canadian ambassador referring to R2P in the lead up to the 2004 coup. But Huffington Post editor told me that they couldn't run this part because it wasn't in any corporate media outlet.
He didn't dispute with you that it existed, that it was real, but it hadn't got the imprimatur of the respectable press.
Exactly.
Thank goodness, I'm not respectable.
It guarantees. The circle is covered. Where if it's only things that are in the respectable dominant media are allowed to be in the Huffington Post, which sort of presents itself as a little bit of a kind of alternative source, despite being multi-billion-dollar corporation. It guarantees the mm-hmm. the exclusion of the counter perspective.
You know, for people to dress up and go to work and call themselves editors and publishers, it's humiliating that they actually are afraid of something that someone puts in a concrete, factual item on their desk and they look at it and realize they're not going to do it unless the Washington Post or the Ottawa Citizen does it. That's embarrassing.
Dominant media works overwhelmingly. Yeah. And it's a follow the pack. It's a, to put it in sort of maybe hockey terms, it's a bunch of chicken shits. Yeah. I recognize that.
That's a scientific term.
How the dynamic works with foreign policy and critical Canadian foreign policy is because there are so few sources of power in this country pushing an alternative perspective. The dominant media has their own biases towards, institutional biases towards power. But there are openings in different circumstances, but there needs to be some other source of power in society, be it, in the case of domestic issues, labor unions that mm-hmm. are pushing a different perspective from the corporate perspective. But on foreign policy, there's just so little in terms of organized opposition or organized source of power, and that includes the opposition mm-hmm. parties like the NDP, mm-hmm. who do very little in terms of pushing back against the dominant perspective of Canadian foreign policy, that the media's ability to just tell mm-hmm. lies that are bigger than mm-hmm. Almost get your head around is kind of almost limitless.
Yes. And by the way, there is a deep cynicism. That's why I think people will be reading your book, because you give them chapter and verse of which there's people's suspicion about mainstream media. It is growing the same way their alienation from, you know, mainstream politicians is clearly getting to the almost a crisis point. We're hearing about The Guardian having trouble with this and the London Telegraph, The New York Times. People starting to laugh now in response to their stories. I want to tell everybody, your tour is going to start tomorrow, isn't it? And you're going to be in Hamilton on the 19th at 7 p.m. at 24 Main Street. And you're going to be at Mack University on October the 20th. And you're going to be at our favorite hangout, Betzatun, at 7 o'clock on the 20th. I have that right. And people, by the way, can go to eveengler.com and get the details about Eve's lectures across the country and touring with his new book. Eve, you tell us the potash story. You wrote an important piece about potash and its connections, I think, it's Nigeria, isn't it?
You know, in the lead-up to the launch in Saskatoon, where Potash Corps is based for the Canada and Africa 300 Years of Aid and Exploitation, I submitted a piece talking about how Potash Corps works with the Moroccan government in taking the non-renewable resources of the last colony in Africa, Western Sahara. I submitted that to the Saskatoon Star Phoenix editor, who had actually had a little bit of interaction with on a couple of other issues in the past, and his response was to say sort of positive thing and say, well, give me a little time to think about it, respond a week later and say, oh, we've had this debate on our pages about Potash's core and Potash Corps' complicity in the occupation of Western Sahara, and we've had both sides lay their peace out, mm-hmm. which seemed a little bit odd to me, because I talked to my brother-in-law who's in Saskatoon, very active person. He was completely unfamiliar with the issue, so I decided to look at Canadian Newsstand on the Saskatoon Star Phoenix, and they'd had a 260-word letter 2.5 years earlier about the issue, and a rebuttal from the head of the company, from a spokesperson for the company. End of debate. No one needs to. The whole story's been told. Let's move on to more important issues, like somebody throwing a beer can at a Toronto Blue Jays game or something like that. Mm-hmm. The editor in this case probably understood that he was going to get a phone call from somebody who was considered important in Saskatoon, and he preferred not to receive that phone call, would be my guess at the basic explanation for why he didn't want to run the piece.
You were Haiti to his Canada. You make a very nice point in this that, you know, what can Haiti do when Canada kicks them around? They don't have any kind of resources to kick back. They can't can't defend themselves. They don't have what the Canadian Army has. And I better ask you about that. I called it the Army. I'm going to be more respectful. The military. The military has operates a PR regime, a machine. Talk about that some.
Biggest PR regime in Canada. Biggest public relations firm in the country. It's not clear the exact number of people, but one, because they're, of course, very secretive. As part of their PR strategy, they're very secretive of their PR strategy. They have, one report says 661 people working on PR and sort of war celebrations, $354 million in 2010-11 fiscal year. Hundreds and hundreds of public affairs officers. So one website lists 50 different PR bureaus across the country that are part of the Department of National Defense. Each staff, presumably, with multiple individuals. And these people are one report said they monitored 29,000 newspaper articles in 1 year. They compile reports on reporters. They obviously, interacting with reporters, seeing who's sympathetic, who's not, who we should release information to, who we shouldn't, things like that. But then they also have a history department, and it goes back a century. The Canadian military has a history department that's played a very important part in writing Canadian military history, and especially in the first, into the 1960s, from after World War One into the 1960s, also played a very important part in academic history, and people trained in the military history department filled lots of academic positions, again into the 60s, a very important voice in that, in academic departments around military studies, around military history, just even in terms of Canadian history more generally. So it's this massive entity that is spending hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of public money every year promoting its view of the world, rewriting the history of the Korean War, rewriting the history of whatever they've been
The Battle of Dieppe, I know, is a very touchy subject.
Exactly.
And they want to make sure that you understand it from the brass point of view.
Exactly. So it's this incredible apparatus that that's probably the area that I was most taken aback with. I've obviously been paying attention to Canadian foreign policy a lot over the past decade or plus, but just the scope of the military, and specifically in this case the military's public relations apparatus, is something that deserves I give it a fair bit of attention in the book, but it's something that deserves a whole lot more attention as well. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's great writing. This is Eve Engler, and the book is A Propaganda System. And Eve is going to be in Toronto on October the 20th at Betts Attoon at 7 p.m. And you can go to eveengler.com and find out all about Eve. That was an accident. And, it was great talking to you, Eve. We look forward to seeing you.
Thanks for having me.
This is Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM. We might have a little music, and we're going to thank Charlotte, and we'll tell you that Indigenous Waves is coming in.